The 8 o'clock hour is supported by Kinney Drugs, offering a suite of pharmacy services, including immunizations, automatic refills, and prescription synchronization. KinneyDrugs.com. And by Paul Vancott of Saranac Lake, serving the North Country as counsel to the law firm of Whiteman, Osterman, and Hanna, online at WOH.com.
This is North Country Public Radio. It's 5 minutes past eight on this Wednesday, the 18th of November. Good morning. I'm Todd Moe.
And I'm Monica Sandreski. With the election over, the New York legislature is facing pressure from many sides to reconvene and deal with the pandemic and state economic problems. More on that in just a few minutes.
The second wave of the coronavirus pandemic continues to hit the North Country hard. The region's counties reported 91 new cases yesterday. That's on top of 120 new cases the day before. 23 people are hospitalized due to COVID-19 in St. Lawrence, Lewis, and Jefferson counties alone. The Alexandria Central School District in Alexandria Bay is switching to remote learning for the rest of the week. In a post on Facebook, Superintendent Chris Clapper said the switch is precautionary. There are no reported cases of the virus. Still, the district says it's working closely with the Jefferson County Health Department on contact tracing.
All counties are experiencing community spread of the virus. Public health officials say you should assume that those around you are potentially infectious. They implore residents to stay at home when they can, wear masks, and maintain 6 feet of social distance at all times in public and wash hands often. Many health officials are cautiously optimistic about a vaccine. Later this morning, we'll find out what it would take to get a vaccine from certification to injection. That's on point between 10 and 11 o'clock.
Police departments across New York State have been instructed to reinvent and modernize their policies and procedures by April of next year. The mandate was part of an executive order signed by Governor Cuomo following widespread protests over police brutality this summer.
As Julia Ritchie reports, some North Country police departments are starting to go public with their plans, but many are struggling to get the word out.
St. Lawrence County Sheriff Brooks Bigwarf says his department is already halfway through completing many of the requirements outlined by the governor's executive order this summer.
We've reviewed and had some amendments and changes from our use of force policy. We've had more biased awareness training, de-escalation training, and we've reviewed all of our policies and procedures.
Bigwarf said they started with an internal review of their policies, looking at things like use of force and the potential purchase of body cameras. He later started meeting with smaller stakeholder groups to get their input, and now he says they're on to step three.
Step three will be the process of having a public hearing, which is going to be on December 21st, followed by a resolution from the county board, and then the fourth process would to send the certification, the resolution down to the director of budget in New York State that we've complied with the police executive order 203.
The police killing of George Floyd in Minneapolis this summer sparked protests nationwide, including in the North Country, where issues of race and policing have often been underacknowledged. Governor Cuomo's executive order in June was part of a suite of reforms passed by New York's legislature. Reform advocates hope this could force an examination of everything from arrest and stop rates of people of color to use of tear gas during protests to body cameras. Other police departments are starting to get the word out about their own reform efforts, though it hasn't exactly been easy in a year with a pandemic, presidential election, and restrictions on gatherings like public meetings. Asked how much public feedback they've actually received so far, Warren County Sheriff Jim LaFarr says,
"Really not a lot, to be honest with you. We put something out on social media. We have a survey that's on our website. We're asking for community feedback."
LaFarr says he will continue to push community outreach as their process moves forward, including their first public meeting today at 2 p.m. That will be streamed live on the county's YouTube page. but he remains skeptical of the rushed process.
The timeline that's been established is, to be quite honest, and I'm not saying this to be offensive towards our governor, it's unrealistic.
Eileen Raymond serves on the Public Safety Advisory Committee for the Village of Canton and has been very involved in the Canton Police Department's reform discussions. Raymond says she'd like to see more coordination among departments, especially in Canton, where the Sheriff's Department and State Police are also headquartered.
I think that it's really, really important that, particularly in jurisdictions that have several policing units in their communities, that all of those units be in sync on how operations are to be handled so that they add to each other's work and don't trip over each other.
LaFarr says it's crunch time for departments to put together a plan that can be approved by the county and sent to the state by April 1st.
You know, if I could stress anything, there really can't be a cookie cutter plan. It's not like you could implement a plan in Albany County that's going to be successful or really valuable in Warren County. In the city of Glens Falls, having their own municipal police department, their plan's going to be very different than ours.
LaFarr says it's important to understand that their work to improve their operations and connect with the community will likely extend well beyond the state's deadline. Julia Ritchie, North Country Public Radio.
The Village of Potsdam is also scheduled to hold its first public meeting on policing starting at 3 o'clock, which will be streamed on its Facebook page. You can find a link to that on our website, ncpr.org.
You're listening to the 8 o'clock hour here on North Country Public Radio. It's 11 minutes past 8. Good morning. I'm Todd Moe.
And I'm Monica Sandreski. Stick around. We'll hear from two outdoorsy North Country residents about their bread recipes that are perfect for hikes, canoe trips, and good friends. That's coming up in just a few minutes right here on the 8 o'clock hour.
Really fun music from Danny Thomas here in Canton. And a reminder that the 8 o'clock hour is supported by Fort DLM Presentacion, home of the Abbey Piquet Walking Trail, open 7 days a week from sunrise to sunset, fort1749.org, and by the Aucible River Association, monitoring lakes and streams and finding solutions that reduce road salt pollution. Learn more at aucibleriver.org.
The Open Space Institute has purchased more than 1,200 acres near the West Mountain Ski Area in Warren County for permanent preservation. According to the Institute, the West Mountain property in the town of Lake Luzerne includes forest and wetlands within the Hudson River watershed. The parcel sits just outside the southeastern border of the Adirondack Park and just north of Moreau Lake State Park. The land is home to a blue heron rookery and is considered good habitat for deer, turkey, bear, and bobcat.
In a press release, OSI President Kim Elliman said it's becoming rare to find large tracts of undeveloped land in fast-growing places like Warren County. He said the parcel will help support clean water, wildlife habitat, recreation, and the storage of carbon to help fight climate change. OSI said the property is expected to be added to the contiguous Ralph Road State Forest through environmental protection funding.
Now that the elections are over, leaders of the New York State Legislature are facing pressure from a wide range of groups to reconvene and deal with pandemic-related economic problems. Legislative leaders say they are not ruling it out. Karen DeWitt reports from Albany.
63 politically progressive advocacy groups wrote a letter to legislative leaders asking them to hold an emergency session before 2020 ends. Sia Weaver is with Housing Justice for All, one of the groups that signed the letter. She says COVID cases are again on the upswing and no federal aid has come from Congress since last April. She says New Yorkers who are struggling to find or keep their jobs and pay rent need more help from their state government.
The legislature has not met since June or July. We are working with families who have no idea how they're going to pay next month's rent, who have no idea how they're going to get medical care or feed their families. It's getting very urgent. And, you know, we need the legislature to go back to work and do their job.
The state has a $15 billion budget deficit, much of it pandemic-related, and Governor Andrew Cuomo has for months now temporarily held back 20% of state aid due to schools and local governments. Weaver says Cuomo has made clear that he is the austerity governor, and she believes the legislature ceded too much power to him over the past several months. She says instead of spending cuts, new taxes should be imposed on the state's billionaires and multimillionaires who have done well financially during the pandemic. Cuomo is against that idea, saying the rich will leave the state, but Senate Leader Andrea Stewart-Cousins and Assembly Speaker Carl Hastie, both Democrats, support imposing new taxes on the wealthy.
The only time we've ever been able to get Cuomo to do anything is when Andrea Stewart-Cousins and Carl Hastie come together and make it clear that it's a priority for them.
Greg Barilla, with the New York State chapter of the National Federation of Independent Businesses, says even if the legislature does not come back for a session this year, he'd like to see lawmakers talk about how to help small businesses that have suffered economic losses during the pandemic. He says many employers worry about an expected spike in unemployment insurance payments in the spring after businesses were required by government health orders to close for several months. That triggered a year of unprecedented layoffs.
We are very concerned that we're going to get into the spring of next year, and knock on wood, COVID might be behind us or getting close to that point. We're going to see small businesses starting to plot their path forward, looking to grow, looking to hire, and they are going to be hammered with new costs and new taxes related to layoffs that were simply not their fault. These are things that may involve a federal solution or at least federal engagement, but the New York State Legislature and leadership in Albany needs to be thinking about it now.
Senate Leader Stewart-Cousins, speaking recently on public radio's The Capitol Press Room, said the legislature had no plans to meet again in what is known as a post-election lame duck session.
Is there any definitive plan to have a lame duck session? No. There isn't.
Stewart-Cousins says now that Democrat Joe Biden is the president-elect, she, like Cuomo, would like to wait a while to see if he can persuade Congress to enact a federal relief package that will close the state's deficit. Democrats in the House have approved an over $2 trillion plan. It would give $33 billion to New York state and local governments to cope with pandemic-related losses. Republicans in the U.S. Senate have not taken up the measure, but Biden backs the bill.
It is much more promising than having a Donald Trump, who was clearly an adversary.
A spokesman for Stewart-Cousins later clarified that the Senate leader is not ruling out a session of the legislature next month. Assembly Speaker Hastie in a tweet said that, to be clear, Assembly Democrats have also not ruled out a return to session this year to address the fiscal health of our state. In Albany, I'm Karen DeWitt.
A new report from the American Lung Association finds states like New York need to do more to protect its indigenous communities and people of color from lung cancer. In its third State of Lung Cancer report, the association's Michael Seelbach says that in New York, the state's indigenous populations are 32% less likely than white people to receive surgery as a first course of treatment.
People of color are simply either being diagnosed later, being routed to treatments that are less effective. We even saw that a large number of Black Americans received no treatment after diagnosis.
Seelbeck says people of color compared to white residents have worse health care options. He says it's important that New Yorkers have quality and affordable health insurance. The report also shows that with better diagnosis and treatment for lung cancer, people are able to live longer, healthier lives with the disease. He says the Lung Association would like to see lung cancer screenings for high-risk patients become as commonplace as mammograms and prostate exams.
Listening to the 8 o'clock hour right here on North Country Public Radio. I'm Todd Moe.
And I'm Monica Sandreski. In just a minute, two stories about baking bread in the outdoors. After that, stick around for Bird Note. Birds that appear to have eyes in the back of their heads. But why is that? We'll consider that just ahead at 8:30. It's 21 degrees in Lake George, 19 degrees in Chateauguay, 20 degrees in Watertown, and 16 degrees in Tupper Lake. We can expect highs in the lower 20s today and the high peaks in the upper 20s and lower 30s elsewhere, but for the most part throughout the region, sunny skies ahead today. Well, last year, we kicked off an occasional series called Bread Time Stories. We heard from listeners across our region with stories and memories of spending time in the kitchen or campsite baking bread. And if you remember last spring at the start of the pandemic, when many stores sold out of flour, it seemed like everyone wanted to bake their own bread, and some did. So we'd like to listen back to our series and invite you to share new bread baking stories this year.
Today, we'll listen again to two bread time stories set in the outdoors. Louise McCarron of Charlotte, Vermont, shares a favorite bread dough recipe that she's used on canoe trips into the Yukon, the Argentine wilderness, and her own kitchen. And Tom Vanderwater of Colton shares sourdough bread stories from biking and hiking trips and how his love of bread spans generations and many friendships.
So bread baking has been in my family for a long time. I've been smelling my grandmother's bread, both my grandmother's and my mom's. And I remember my grandmother telling me how to knead for at least 10 minutes before putting the bread to rise. But I don't really follow that anymore unless I'm feeling like kneading for more meditative purposes. But when I was 19, my friend Dave at Moose Creek Ranger Station in Idaho taught me that bread made from freshly ground wheat was amazingly good. And he also taught me some simple kneading methods that I still use. So I thank him for that. And I have been baking bread pretty much ever since. During the ice storm of 1998, I'd started a sourdough that was from Laurel's Kitchen Bread Book, and kept it going for year after year. I'd try making all different kinds of sourdough breads, even some sourdough bagels that I one time remember bringing in during the ice storm into NCPR. So it's been fun to do breads as gifts. But I've also carried this small container of sourdough with me on long biking and hiking trips. And I'd often share starter with people who were interested in making bread and making bread for people that I really had just met. So several summers ago, I forgot my sourdough starter at home. And while I was working on a fire lookout in Idaho, I visited a friend who was dying of cancer and who'd always made amazingly great bread and pancakes from sourdough. And Warren gave me some of his starter, which was great to have. And he'd gotten it from his friend, Bud Moore, who was a Rocky Mountain trapper and ranger, kind of a true sourdough. And it's the starter that I still have and I've been using for bread every week since. So I've continued to give lessons in sourdough to anybody who's interested. And this summer, another friend gave us a recipe of a sourdough seed bread that I've been making this fall. So every time I bake bread, I think about all those who've come before and who are ahead. So it's kind of the perfect medium for being present and making something good, but knowing it's connected to the past and the future.
My name is Louise McCarran. I live in Shalott, Vermont, and I'm a longtime fan and supporter of North Country Public Radio. The bread, or actually the technique that I'm going to talk about, is something that we worked on and developed for our many, many wilderness canoe trips up in Yukon, Alaska, Nunavut. And when you're out on a trip for 3 weeks, people get hungry, so you need to feed them. What it is, it's pretty straightforward. It's a mixture of flour, instant yeast, hot tap water, which out in the bush we would just use some water left over from tea, and a very small amount of sugar. And you beat that mixture together to it's a pretty thick paste. And then even at home, but out there, you'd put it in a large plastic tub with a cover. And you let it ferment at least 12 hours, but it's good up to 3 days. And we would stick the couple of bowls under the front seat of the canoe. And then when we got into camp, we'd obviously have to gather wood and build a fire and build a fireplace. And then we would, at the end of into the coals, you would put the bread, which you had now kneaded in this large bowl, into a hot pot and cover that up and leave it to whoever was staying up in camp to watch. So sometimes we had great bread and sometimes not so great bread. The other great use of the dough is in the mornings to make English muffins. And we would just take clumps of dough, handfuls of dough, knead them a little bit, and let them rise. And if necessary, put them near the fire and let them rise up. And then you fry them in a cast iron frying pan with some oil or butter and a little cover, and you'd have fabulous English muffins for everybody to eat for breakfast. To do that, we would bring a cast iron frying pan. And, you know, people would kind of complain and get cranky on portages about the pot and the cast iron pan, but, hey, they loved it, all of the muffins and the bread, and it really went a long way to making the trips a lot more fun. And you can do this at home. I do it all the time. The dough also makes fabulous pizza crust. You just roll it out, and it makes great rolls as well. So it's one of our family stories about being out in the woods and still being able to eat well. And that's my bread story. Out there, there's no predetermined camping places. You know, you just, at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, because you're paddling 6 to 7 hours a day, you look for a place to camp. And everybody has a job. You got to unload all the boats. You got to, you know, find places to put the tents. Somebody's got to go get wood. And, you know, somebody's got to build a fireplace. And so you're pretty hungry.
And it tastes better outdoors, too, right?
Well, that was always my theory as the cook. People were grateful for my food.
You'll find photos and recipes from our Breadtime Stories series at ncpr.org. And we want to encourage you, share your pandemic bread baking stories with us. Maybe you bake a lot of bread and are trying new recipes. I know, Todd, you tried your hand at baguettes during the pandemic, if that's right. How'd they turn out?
They did. They turned out great.
Right on.
And you know, maybe between that first and second rise of the dough, you've got time to, you know, jot down your story and then email it to us or contact us, right?
Exactly. Or maybe you're just giving bread baking a shot for the first time, yeah. And even in a bread maker, that is just fine. You can email news@ncpr.org and we will get in touch with you.
And Monica, speaking of food, bread, and all the, you know, all those other great holiday treats, we're going to be talking about food with Chef Curtis Hem for an entire hour-long call-in on Friday morning at 11 o'clock, and we want your participation. Join us tune in, call in at 11 o'clock Friday morning, or you can email your questions in advance for Chef Curtis, one of the North Country's top chefs. He's going to be with us live on the air Friday morning. Email us your question if you'd like, radio@ncpr.org, and join us on Friday, 11 o'clock, right
and
here.
I will say one thing that I'm excited about for this is that as all of us are having small Thanksgivings this year, just with the people in our own household, he has said to us, he let us know ahead of time that he can provide guidance for how to pare down your Thanksgiving meal for just the people in your home. So I'm really looking forward to that.
Yeah, my mother used to say, you know, you got to eat, right? So whether it's two people or, you know, five people, whatever, join us. We'll talk about food Friday with Chef Curtis right here. By Canton composer Michael Farley. It's coming up on 8:30. Stay tuned for Bird Note in just a moment. We'll check a community calendar, and then there's more of Morning Edition just ahead. The 8 o'clock hour is supported by Mountain Orthotic and Prosthetic Services, committed to providing professional and compassionate care in Lake Placid and Plattsburgh. Details and referrals at mountainonp.com. And by St. Lawrence Nurseries in Potsdam, providing the North Country with cold, hardy fruit and nut trees for nearly 100 years. stlawrencenurseries.com.
This is Bird Note. Back in grade school, we all likely had a teacher with an uncanny ability, even with her back turned, to sense when we were up to no good. You might say she had eyes in the back of her head. In nature, there are a few birds that actually appear to have eyes in the back of their heads. Birds like the northern pygmy owl have large, black, eye-shaped markings on the feathered back of their brown heads, a plumage adaptation that creates a pair of false eyes. But why? One theory is that large false eyes may deter predators. They create the illusion that the pygmy owl is much bigger than its 6 3/4 inch size. A more current theory is that the false eyes help protect the pygmy owl's true eyes. The little owl, which is active during daylight, is often subject to aggressive mobbing. Small birds will surround, scold, and even strike the pygmy owl, with some attacks directed at its eyes. If the large false eyes can take the brunt of these attacks, little harm will come to the owl's vulnerable true eyes. For Bird Note, I'm Mary McCann. Support for Bird Note comes from the Cornell Labs Bird Academy, with online courses that share the wonder and joy of birds. More at allaboutbirds.org.
Coming up on 8:32, broadcast at the 8 o'clock hour is supported by Blue Seed Studios, a multidisciplinary arts center featuring classes for adults and youth, concerts, art exhibits, and more. BLUSeedStudios.org. And by Tug Hill Tomorrow Land Trust, helping kids and their families fall in love with nature. Learn more at TugHillTomorrowLandTrust.org. I'm Todd Moe.
And I'm Monica Sandreski. You've still got a couple of days to submit your creative writing responses to the Adirondack Center for Writing. They've been doing weekly writing responses throughout the pandemic. And this week's prompt goes like this. They say, create a holiday of your own and the ways in which it can be celebrated. They have a maximum word count of 750 words, and you could submit your creative writing response by 3 o'clock on Friday to the Adirondack Center for Writing.org.
Okay, if you like holiday decorations, Long Lake, Racket Lake, they've got holiday lights contests coming up, and these are open to all residents and businesses in the town of Long Lake. and in Racket Lake. The judging will be on Tuesday, December 22nd, starting at 5, and there'll be cash prizes and plaques for the businesses with the best lights. They do want you to sign up to be included in the judging, especially if you kind of live off the beaten path. You can email longlake@mylonglake.com. And then in Racket Lake, the contest is open to all residents and businesses in Racket Lake. No need to sign up to be included in the judging. And they'll be judging on Thursday, December 17th at 5 p.m. Holiday light contests. Great stuff.
Great stuff. That is our show for the day. The Morning Edition is coming up in just a minute. After that, stick around for the Marketplace Morning Report between 8:51 and 9 o'clock. Home Depot and Lowe's have seen gains over the summer during the pandemic as many are occupying time at home with improvement projects. But with the winter ahead, how might that change? We'll consider that. Plus, we'll get all the morning's business news just ahead at 8:51 right here on North Country Public Radio. Until tomorrow, I'm Monica Sandreski.
And I'm Todd Moe. Be well.